With the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Taylor Hillman.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 5th, and today is very important because it's the last day to participate in the 5-year agricultural census. At last count on Friday, University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources said only 26% of California producers have responded. Here's Brian German with more on the deadline.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service reminds farmers that the deadline for the 2017 Census of Agriculture is today, February 5th. Returning the completed census is a legal requirement in which the law states that all those who receive a Census of Agriculture report form to respond even if they did not operate a farm or ranch in 2017. The first few qualifying questions on the form will determine whether completing the entire questionnaire is necessary. The USDA mailed questionnaires to over 3 million U.S. producers in December 2017. As of January 29th, approximately 22% of California producers had already responded, which is close to the national return rate of just over 23%. Farmers and ranchers can respond to the census online at agcounts.usda.gov by the end of the day. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue says the census for farmers is, quote, their voice, their future, their opportunity. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian. And now to our top story today. The Department of Water Resources delivered bad news last week when the second snowpack measurement in 2018 showed well below average results. DWR does the manual survey at the Phillips Station 90 miles east of Sacramento, then releases all of the monitoring station's data from the Sierras. The Phillips Station measured 13.6 inches of snow, with a snow water equivalent of 2.6 inches, just 14% of the early February average. The Northern Sierras as a whole measured 27% of average, Central Sierras 30% of average, and Southern Sierras just 25% of average. Officials were hoping the storms that passed through the state in January would have increased the alarmingly low snowpack totals seen in the early January measurement. California Cooperative Snow Surveys Program Chief Frank Gerke commented on the bad news, but offered some hope in saying that, quote, the snow survey today shows water content far below average for this time of year. Today's measurements indicate an anemic snowpack to date, but there's still the possibility of a wet February and March. Dry, unseasonably warm temperatures are in the forecast, but meteorologists say it's nearly impossible to predict weather in California past 10 days. DWR Director Carla Nemeth added to the optimism, yet cautioned Californians to be prepared, saying, quote, California experiences the most variable weather in the nation. It's vital that water conservation efforts remain consistent regardless of the year's precipitation. There may be a little bit of a snow drought, but not a water drought as of yet. Although the amount of rain-producing storms has been relatively low, the ones that did pass through provided substantial amounts, and that's good news for the state's reservoirs. On February 1st, 9 of the 12 state reservoirs were at or well over 100% of their historical averages, and a tenth was just under. And that's including the Oroville Dam, which is low because of the failure. Trinity, Shasta, Malonis, San Luis, Don Pedro, Millerton, and Castaic are all over 70% capacity. From a national perspective, is the U.S. heading for another major drought such as we had in 2012? Most weather experts say there's no way to know for sure, but there are some troubling signs. Gary Crawford has more.
We have gone 60 days without any rainfall.
The heat, drought,
our pastures are completely burned up.
Devastating on folks.
Voices of farmers during the 2012 drought, the worst since the 1950s, a drought that began to really show itself in early February that year. Fast forward and look at conditions now.
There are some disturbing similarities.
Uh-oh, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey first. Just like early 2012,
we have a fairly significant La Nina in place,
which oftentimes brings expanding drought. Second, looking at the percentage of the country either abnormally dry or in actual drought,
we actually have a greater coverage at this point than we did at this time in 2012.
67% versus 58% February 2012. And for actual drought coverage, identical now with 2012, 38%. And in the last month, coverage has expanded rapidly, just like 2012. But will it race into the Midwest as in 2012?
That remains to be seen.
So Rippey says don't be overly alarmed at this point. Just be watchful. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Sonoma County Wine Growers President Carissa Cruz, who lost her home in the recent North County fire, helped spread the message at the Unified Wine and Grape Symposium that most of the damage from the fire was residential, not agricultural. As the region rebuilds, Cruz said the easiest way to help is to not avoid the area and its products.
We had one winery completely lost, Paradise Ridge, which was right in the heart of kind of the Fountain Grove neighborhood, which was where my home was. But other than that, I mean, we lost fences, we lost barns, we certainly, you know, there were some, you know, livestock running free for a few days. But, you know, it was a community that was most impacted. You know, we were already in a housing crisis before the fires. So, I mean, that's where the focus really is on kind of the rebuild effort. And I think, you know, what we keep telling people, you know, the worst thing you can do for Sonoma County is to, you know, believe or have the misperception that, you know, our vineyards were lost or our wineries were lost or that the 2017 vintage is lost. I mean, most of it was in, most of it was already being processed. It's going to be alive and well. We actually were drinking some Sauv Blanc or Pinot Grigio actually from the 2017 vintage today here at this conference. And I mean, it's great wine. And I think the best thing people can do is to continue to support Sonoma County and Napa Valley and Mendocino and Lake County and you know, buy our wines. That drives money right back into the economy that is helping those families directly rebuild their lives.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City News Day. More agriculture news for you now.
The Natural Resources Conservation Service will be presenting information on some of the services they offer at the Colusa Farm Show on Tuesday, February 6th in the Stagehand Theater. NRCS District Conservationist for Colusa, Wendy Crable, will be participating in the seminar that begins at 1 p.m. She noted some of the information that will be presented as to what NRCS can provide for farmers.
We help producers look at the wildlife aspect and building habitat, and we also look at plant health, as in how can we help not grow their crops, but sustain or rejuvenate their crop production. And so we might do that by helping them with the water quality or water quantity in installing irrigation systems, or help them with a conservation crop or some type of cover crop, and that might address soil health, thereby addressing plant health.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
State agriculture officials are questioning the Trump administration on the promise of new bilateral trade deals. During a meeting in Washington, D.C. last week, the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture members commented on the lack of new bilateral agreements, as promised by the administration a year ago. Trump promised bilateral agreements as he withdrew the U.S. from the multilateral Trans-Pacific Partnership. Montana Agriculture Department Director Ben Thomas told Politico, quote, "We haven't really seen any substance behind that." The Democrat also mentioned Trump's comments regarding joining the TPP if the deal got what he called substantially better. Thomas encouraged the organization to start thinking about what those terms may be. The TPP was recently revived by the 11 other countries involved in the pact that are planning to sign and amend the version in March.
Well, in today's livestock news, there are some wondering whether 2018 will be another year of expansion in the beef industry. Well, Gary Crawford had a chance to talk with a USDA livestock analyst to get his thoughts from the latest USDA cattle report.
Will 2018 be the fifth year in a row of expansion in the beef cattle herd and in beef production, or will it not? Wednesday's twice-yearly USDA cattle inventory report has numbers that could support either conclusion. USDA livestock analyst Chael Shagham told us returns to cattle producers now and expected returns are
not conducive to large expansion, but at the moment it's not conducive to a significant contraction. I think to some extent that did show up in the numbers, the fact that we are looking at cow numbers which were already 2% above a year ago.
On the other hand, as to heifers being held back for breeding,
producers indicated that they were holding back about 6.1 million head of heifers for beef cow replacement, which would be 4% below a year ago.
And the proportion of heifers in feedlots is higher, but feedlot total inventory is up 7% from a year ago. The 2017 calf crop was up 2%. So Shagham says he thinks
there is still going to be some expansion in beef production during 2018.
Latest forecast about a 6% increase. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Thanks, Gary. And USDA livestock analyst Chael Shagham has key numbers from that latest USDA cattle report.
The number of cattle and calves in the U.S. on January 1st was 94.4 million head, which was about 1% above 2017. We had about 31.7 million beef cows, which was 2% above a year ago, and about 9.4 million dairy cows, which was about 1% above a year ago. Producers indicated that they were holding back about 6.1 million head of heifers for beef cow replacement, which would be 4% below a year ago. If we look at the number of steers, 500 pounds and over, that was 16.4 million head, about unchanged from a year ago. And the number of calves under 500 pounds was about 14.4 million head, also very close to last year's number. The number of cattle on feed in all U.S. feedlots was 14 million head, which was 7% above a year earlier. The calf crop for 2017 was estimated at 35.8 million head, which was 2% above a year ago.
Again, that was USDA livestock analyst Cheryl Shagum with numbers from the latest USDA cattle report. And late last week, the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia issued a ruling on a suit challenging the sale of the pork, the other white meat trademark. The National Pork Producers Council sold the trademarks to the National Pork Board back in 2006, but HSUS and other plaintiffs claimed that the trademarks were sold for an inflated price. The National Pork Producers Council sold the assets widely regarded as some of the most recognizable market brand assets in history for $35 million. But the court's recent decision followed a motion last January to dismiss the lawsuit that was filed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which authorized the transaction as part of its oversight responsibilities under the 1985 Pork Act. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
I know it was just recently that I did a report on what agriculture does for the economy of our country. To me, it's important that every individual, including schoolchildren, be taught and understand that those planted fields you see as you drive across your county or across the whole country are more than just crops that keep a farmer in business. I've told you that one out of five jobs in America are somehow connected to agriculture. These are jobs that won't go offshore, where wages are lower, and these are jobs that are not connected to any one sector. They are in every state. One other thing. These jobs should be just as important to our elected officials, both local and in Washington, as they are to people at home. Is it something you ever think about? That's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, Agnet West.
This is Farm City News Day by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City News Day by Agnet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's interview segment, Agnet West's Gary Cooper talked to HM Close's Vice President of Sales at the American Seed Trade Association's Vegetable and Flower Seed Conference in San Diego last week.
I'm Matthew Thomas with HM Close. I'm the Vice President of Sales for the USA, Canada, and Australia, and I was born and raised and still live in Madison, Wisconsin.
And brand new in the job, I understand, for the North American continent and Australia. You might start right there. Similarities between the two that causes the region to get carved out like that, or what?
Exactly. So the consumer trends and the market trends and the growing conditions between North America and Australia, we've found are the most mirror image of each other. It's difficult to have Asia covering Australia because the crops are completely different. Europe has some similarities, but the distance is even further than the U.S., so that's how we've carved out that region to be part of USA.
Well, that makes sense in visiting with some of your R&D and research folks. Y'all kind of look at crop conditions, and that kind of guides you, the farmers' issues and those kind of things. Sounds like it guides your R&D and your development of new products, so I guess the sales is aligning itself with those philosophies as well.
That's absolutely correct, yes.
Where do you, I guess a big question for folks that are brand new in jobs like yours is, what's going to change? But here we're at the ASTA meeting, American Seed Trade Association in San Diego this week. Interesting program. Changes around us. Change is coming. It sounds like change is going to impact us all. So it's more how are we going to deal with the change we're facing more than what we plan to change. Am I on target with that?
That's correct. When I started my new role, the first question out of most people's minds were, what are you going to change? And my answer was, nothing right now. And I feel they've come to me with the change, based on how you're going to change the distribution model, or how are you going to change where we have reps, or who we sell to and how we sell to them, where that's more restructuring in my mind. Where I see the change coming is how we go to the growers and how we attract new talent, because the age of people in the seed industry and in farming and food production is creeping up, as we all know. So we need to attract new talent, and the growers need to attract new talent, to have some succession planning. But with that, we're not going to be able to, none of us will be successful if we just continue to do the same things that we've done over the last 10, 15, 20 years. We need to look at other industries, see what's worked for innovation in terms of whether it's reaching customers, reaching growers, how we market our seeds, how we distribute our seeds. So change to me will be on a bigger, broader scale than simply a reorganization.
Well, you know, when you look at the new technologies and some of the things coming down the pike, I mean, in addition to what you just described, it seems like you got to get your arms around how to take those new folks and that new identity and the people coming in and being trained to like you say, to replace the older folks going out. But at the same time, melding all this new technology and the drive of things coming into the agriculture that's going to modernize all of us even more.
Exactly. So a lot of the change in the industry has been focused on the growers, whether it's mechanical harvesting or higher quality seed and transplants. But the model of how we get seed from our production to our distributors to our growers hasn't changed, and I see the way of doing business in the future. We need to adapt to ensure that we're capturing and we're hitting the right grower base on how they want to be contacted.
Well, you know, HM Close, a parent company, Le Magrand in France, French farmers own the company, so it makes it a lot different, I think, than many companies in the seed industry globally. But with farmer ownership, there seems to be, and just knowing some of your folks at the grassroots level in the markets we serve, there's a great liaison between your field reps and the farmers themselves. You know, your field reps in many cases are the face of the company, and they, the farmers seem to have, from the pumpkins out here to the vegetables in South Florida in the Glades and wherever we go in the region, they seem to have, they kind of feel ownership in terms of being able to give input to the company to gather help back on variety research or whatever. I guess that's kind of going to remain a strong point for you guys going forward.
Absolutely. Internally, we like to say it's a great story, but it's beyond a story. It's a philosophy of how we're doing business. We have our cooperative owners, and they're in it for the long haul to invest in research and development, to make sure that we're on the cutting edge on product development, and that's where the innovation I see coming as far as how we go to market.
How do farmers, how do you crystal ball the future? I mean, you guys in the seed business are getting down to where you can put traits in seeds and grow for dry lands, wet lands, tomato plants. You've got so many varieties for so many different conditions in the field, whether it be soil types or moisture or climate or whatever. Where do you see that going? Are we going to keep seeing more and more varieties? And if so, it's almost, how will the farmer be able to make up his mind? I mean, it just seems like there's just a plethora of these new products coming on board, not only from y'all, but from other companies.
Absolutely, there are. And because of the different microclimates and the consolidation within the industry and some of our climate change that's happening, we definitely need to have different varieties to hit these different planting slots. Yield quality needs to remain consistent throughout the chain, throughout the season. And to have one variety to do that is really getting more and more challenging.
Matthew Thomas, appreciate your time today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back.
This is Tricia Blattler with Tulare County Farm Bureau, and you're listening to AgNet West Radio. This is Ryan Jacobson, Fresno County Farm Bureau CEO, and you're listening to AgNet West Radio Network.
Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now. Several in the farm sector see new gene editing technologies as the latest advancement in traditional plant and animal crossbreeding methods. Rod Bain has more.
Gene editing, the way that we're looking at it, it's an evolution of breeding.
Some of the folks who work in this area call it precision crossbreeding, and I think that's an interesting way to think about it.
Andy Levine of the American Seed Trade Association and Dan Mosier of the American Angus Association, respectively, discussing gene editing technologies, which they say not only reflects traditional crossbreeding methods for plants and animals, but in ways that greatly expedite the crossbreeding process. Luther Marquardt of the American Sugar Alliance says this takes on increased significance when talking about matters such as creating genetic resistance to a disease or pest threat, or assuring there is enough food to feed the global population by the year 2050.
We don't have that kind of time. You've got to be able to have that technology that will really give consumers healthy food at reasonable prices and be able to speed up the ability to make advances in those varieties.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
With the current farm economy, farmers have options such as direct marketing to find added value. Chad Smith has more.
There's no question the farm economy is flat right now. Farmers around the country are taking steps to find more value-added products they can produce in an effort to improve their bottom lines. Michael Bolin, professor of ag economics at the University of Minnesota, says one method is direct marketing to consumers.
I've been a reviewer for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Value-Added Producer Grant Program since 2001, when it was first formed. And the one thing I could see after all these years is we have an uptick in farmer interest in value-added agriculture, and direct marketing is part of that value-added agriculture. As you think about how farmers, what does that mean to farmers? Well, in simple terms, it could be something simple as selling at a farmer's market. Here in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, we're now seeing our farmer's markets open 12 months a year.
Farmers are also able to market their products to local restaurants and grocery stores as more and more of those businesses are trying to buy locally. Farmers are also looking at marketing products made from animal agriculture, including cheese, as an opportunity to add value. He says the demand for locally produced goods has grown rapidly, which he has seen firsthand during recent meals with friends.
I had supped with someone else and they had soup and they were using the feet from chicken for the gelatin in their stew. And so you're seeing a number of people experimenting with different recipes that are using different parts of the animal carcass. If you think about returning to a cooking process, they want to cook things from scratch. They want to know what the products are going into the pot for stew or soup or whatever the case may be. So you're seeing a certain segment of consumers who are very much focused on what can I do to cook my own food and know what's going into my crock pot or my pot on the stove, however they're cooking.
Bolin says consumer demand for locally produced food year-round has led to things like aquaponics and hydroponics in order to supply produce all year long to restaurants. A hops industry has taken off in Minnesota because of the craft brewing industry. He says the growth in demand for locally produced foods is linked to the sustainability movement.
People want to know where their food comes from. People have got less children. I'm the oldest of 12 kids, and people don't have families like that anymore in general. And so people can afford to use more of their income, if you will, on food, as opposed to just pursuing an inexpensive food policy or the so-called cheap policy that our farm programs have been hallmarked by. So I think people are more interested in knowing where some of their food comes from. I think that you look at people sharing. You know, we have a huge food cooperative movement here in Minneapolis-St. Paul. It's amazing what that does. People start sharing recipes. They start sharing what the people working in the food cooperative, and it's not just food cooperatives, but a number of other retail grocery stores, they're sharing how they're using things. They might have a chef in there for a couple hours on a Saturday or during the weekday, and people stop and watch what that person's doing and interact with that person. It gives them an idea on how to use them as foods.
Resources are available online for producers interested in taking part in the direct-to-consumer market.
The U.S. Congress funds the ATRA, the Alternative Technology Transfer Center at the University of Arkansas. So ATRA, A-T-T-R-A, has got a website with a number of ways to learn more about pasture-fed poultry, a number of production issues related to production and marketing issues of animal agriculture and vegetables and fruits and other types of foods. Each state has a small farms coordinator, so typically these are in colleges of agriculture within the Cooperative Extension Service. Someone is responsible in that state for the small farms program, and they can be a point of reference for people to start who want to look at this.
The Ag Marketing Resource Center at Iowa State University also has a lot of information available to help producers interested in direct selling. The web address, www.agmrc.com. Chad Smith reporting.
To get more information on topics you've heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German @BrianAgNetWest and Taylor Hillman @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.